This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BeHereNow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BeHereNow.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/BeHereNow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Again, in my actual life, having those relative experiences enables me to touch into the absolute in the midst of daily life. And that's especially true with I would call it the kind of dharmic use of psychedelics. So obviously the experience itself, especially if it's a long experience, has its own teaching. And also, you know, it's possible to train the mind to remember.
Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with David Nichtern on the Be Here Now Network. My name is Michael Kammers, your host and monologist. And on behalf of all of us at Be Here Now and Dharma Moon, we sincerely hope this podcast finds you as well as can be, and we are grateful that you are joining us. Here at CSM, our guy, David Nichtern, discusses how to lead an integrated life involving spiritual practice, creative expression, and right livelihood with guests who embody and manifest these principles in their own life. And for this episode, we are very fortunate to have the very accomplished polymath, Rabbi Dr. Jay Michelson, joining us. Jay Michelson works at the intersection of politics, law, and contemplative practice. A journalist, meditation teacher, and professor, Jay is the author of 10 books and over 300 articles. Given our esteemed guest's background, the conversation on this episode is far-ranging and deep. So prepare yourself to dive into discussion touching on a broad range of important topics through the lens of spiritual practice. And speaking of meditation practice, before we get into the episode, we would like to encourage everyone to head over to dharmamoon.com and check out the offerings we currently have up on our website. We are very excited to share. We have Sharon Salzberg in conversation with Ethan Nichtern on December 19th, 2023 on Zoom for a conversation entitled Finding Stability in an Unstable World, Why Buddhist Teachings Are More Relevant Than Ever. And given the current state of the world and human relations, it's an important topic with two great teachers. The gathering will also discuss Ethan's year-long Buddhist studies program, which runs in a number of chunks throughout the year, and you can always hop into a cohort if you are interested in the program. And as always, the third Sunday of every month is our community sit, and we run 100-hour mindfulness meditation teacher programs all year. So regardless when you're listening to this, if you are interested in connecting with mindful community, please head over to dharmamoon.com. Also, we'd like to thank Be Here Now Network for hosting and distributing our humble podcast. Big shout out to everyone there. And we encourage all of our listeners to head over to BeHereNowNetwork.com to check out the ever-growing archive of podcasts sharing and discussing our world's wisdom traditions and carrying on Ram Dass's legacy. Okay, So now I have the unenviable position of giving some background on our most prodigious guest to date, and then we'll get right to the conversation. J. Michelson's work transcends the ability of the short or medium-length bio to transmit a sense of his activities and who he is. On his website, there are four different short bios that are context-specific. After some contemplation, I think a good way to start his introduction is simply to read the titles of these bios. Bio number one, focusing on LGBTQ activism, legal work, and religious exemptions. Bio number two, focusing on the Gate of Tears. Jay is a prolific author. Bio number three, focusing on Buddhism and meditation. And bio number four, focusing on Jewish writing, teaching, and leadership. Highlights from his longer bio include: Jay is a contributing writer to New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, The Daily Beast, and other publications, where he most frequently writes about the Supreme Court, religion, LGBTQ issues, and climate change. He has appeared on NPR, CNN, and MSNBC. Jay is also a teacher, podcast host, and editor at 10% Happier. He's written several books about meditation and spirituality, including The Gate of Tears, Sadness and the Spiritual Path, and Evolving Dharma, Meditation, Buddhism, and the Next Generation of Enlightenment. He is also a non-denominational rabbi and frequently writes and teaches about Jewish theology and mysticism. Finally, Jay is an affiliated assistant professor at Chicago Theological Seminary and a visiting fellow at the Center for LGBTQ and Gender Studies and Religion. And if you're interested in learning more about Jay and his work, head over to jmichelson.net. You can also follow him on Instagram, where his handle is jmichelson on Insta. And we would like to conclude this intro by wholeheartedly recommending his upcoming book, The Secret That Is Not a Secret, his first book of fiction. It is a collection of interconnected short stories whose inhabitants are torn between the transcendent and the earthly. You can pre-order it now through links on his website for its release on December 5th, 2023. Okay, friends, that's our opening monologue, and now on to the main event, episode number 48 of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast with Jay Michelson.
Okay, welcome back, everybody, to the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast. Highly qualified to illuminate us on all three points in different combinations is Jay Michelson, who I'm meeting just for the first time, but very happy to be. Jay, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
I thought just by sharing a little bit about, I was going to say that the word eclectic in the dictionary has your picture in it. Were you aware of that?
It should. I should. We were talking about making a buck. I should monetize that and get a commission.
Okay. Well, I get my usual 85%. That's the deal I have with
good. That sounds like a good music royalty deal. Isn't that what you got for the songwriting? You got your 15?
Yeah, I got it from the music industry. It's like they get 85%. You should be glad they're even talking to you. But I'm going to just read a little bit about how you summed up your world. And then maybe we could launch from there, see what you want to talk about from within there. So I like the way you start. I've struggled with this intersection my entire life. If not struggled, then worked with it in weird ways. And here's the thing that our audience coming from different directions would want to know. My jobs have included journalist, spiritual book writer, LGBTQ activist for 10 years, meditation app content editor, podcast host for 4 years. Now this is where I dropped the mic. Rabbi, I like the placement of that is very good. Rabbi, professor, and law professor, fiction book writer, lawyer, law clerk, startup founder in 2000, stayed through 2007, indie online magazine founder editor, and I've had financial services side hustle for the last year as well. Now, here's where, just in case anybody's starting to snooze, not to mention the PhD, JD, rabbinic ordination, Dharma teacher transmission, MFA, 3 albums, 10 books. I say this not to brag in any way, but to confess as the both and ness of my life is both a blessing and a curse. So maybe that's an interesting that's like driving a truck through the defensive line of the, you know, of the New York Jets, and then you go wherever you want to go from there. So
please, one of those you could drive a unicycle through the defensive line of the New York Jets. Also, I'm very proud that I just made an accurate football reference. That's not my usual swim lane.
A unicycle through the defensive line. That's good. And then as a songwriter, I'm starting to work on that.
I live
right
like
away.
5 miles from what's now MetLife Stadium, Giant Stadium, where the Jets play. So wow. I feel particularly qualified to say things about the Jets, even though I haven't watched a football game in 4 years.
Does the football ever come crashing through your window of your living room?
Once they allow more steroid use, I heard that it will. Yeah, it'll fly right into sunny Montclair.
Montclair, sunny Montclair. That's a good title for a song right there.
The sun's coming through the window right now. I should remember which place to record podcast episodes in the afternoon.
Well, Montclair is a nice place to live. I think. Would you say? Are you from there?
Yeah, I grew up in the suburbs and I hated them and swore I would never, ever, ever live in the suburbs. But like a lot of people, you know, I had a kid living in the city and, you know, I'm friends with your son. So, I know the struggle of, you know, kids in the city, and we just decided to do it. And I actually really love it out here. It's a little liberal bubble in the center of New Jersey or the north of New Jersey.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. You ended up back where you started. There's a lot of poetry in that. And what about Brooklyn? Did you consider Brooklyn?
No, we lived in Brooklyn. I lived in Brooklyn for 15 years, but we were priced out. There's just no way. Well, if we wanted to be in a decent public school district, you know, the prices were just, I want the life of living in Park Slope in 1985, where you could buy a brownstone on a meditation teacher's salary, you know, and go to the Pavilion and watch movies all the time. Basically, the movie The Squid and the Whale was the life that I wanted, but it hasn't been economically accessible for 20 years.
Yeah, you know, when you said that, it made me think I was living in Soho in the late 60s, early 70s. I wish I'd bought every building then.
You must have had some cool neighbors, though. Not to encourage you to drop names, but that must
have
been.
There were a lot of artists and cool musicians and stuff, but living in what you would then, the bathtub would be in the living room of the loft.
Right.
And those buildings, like, just, you could have bought them for couple of hundred grand each back then. I'm sure somebody did.
Right, let's change the subject.
So of those myriad accomplishments, and let's call it like it is, that's a lot of accomplishment, Jay.
I'm just like a broke version of Elon Musk. You know how he does 20 different things and makes $1 billion? I tried 20 different things and didn't make any money.
Well, okay. You did not make any money because you're not wandering around the streets. So.
No, that's right. Yeah, no, I just didn't do it. I mean, I think, like I said in that email, which I didn't know you were going to read, it's every so often I pondered doing a version of your book, because I've had this like multi-career polymath life, and I can spin it in a way that I think is compelling. And to be honest, just in the last year, I've started a new newsletter and I'm doing a lot of work specifically at like some of the intersections of those different fields that you mentioned. Yeah. So there's ways to spin it. And I think I feel very good about some of the work that I've been doing recently. And yet it's also been a kind of career suicide. In Silicon Valley talk, I optimized for seizing the day. I saw the movie Dead Poets Society when I was 18 and I read a lot of Allen Ginsberg, and I just, I was convinced like this is what I wanted. I wanted, I'm also an Enneagram 7 for people who follow that. So, I want every possible experience that there is, even the bad ones. I just, want every experience. And I became a parent because I'm an Enneagram 7. I wanted that experience. And, I definitely can look back on the first half century of my life and say, really with joy and confidence, I seized the day. I didn't even include the things I was in a garage rock band in the early 2000s. And I've been to Burning Man 14 times. Like there's stuff that didn't even make it on that list. But when I quote, again, I use this language tongue in cheek, the optimizing Silicon Valley language, but optimizing for seize the day is not the same as optimizing for a certain kind of credibility and status in any one individual career. So sure. I've just lived with that. And I think it's in a way I'm you know, a good guest for you in a way, a terrible guest, because it's kind of like I didn't follow the advice that one would want to follow if you wanted to get, you know, that tenured professorship and or that, you know, plum position in X or Y career. That being said, there are many times in my work life where I've had either all, let's say, law, politics, et cetera, or all spirituality, meditation, et cetera, or some, you know, and it doesn't feel great. I love the balance and I love the mix of these different worlds and code switching between them. You know, speaking in meditation voice in the meditation hall and then speaking in CNN voice when I'm on CNN. And that I find really nourishing, for better or for worse.
Well, you know, one of the chapters in the book says defining success on your own terms is important. So do you feel that your version of success is to be eclectic and to carpe the diem, as you would say?
Yeah. You made it sound like gefilte fish. Yeah, I think all right, that's good. I don't know if you're going to edit out the laughing, but that's, I hope you keep it in.
Oh, no, we don't edit out the laughing here. No way.
I think I've had, and I've thought about this a lot, actually. You know, there seem to me different vectors by which I evaluate a life well lived for myself. Obviously, I'm not here to judge anybody else's vectors. You know, one of them is honestly my books and my legacy. I feel really good about the books that I've written. Book number 10 is coming out in December of 2023, probably in the rearview mirror when folks hear this. And I feel great about that, even though they're not bestsellers. You know, my dream is that, you know, after I'm gone, some young person maybe will find it in some university library and it'll resonate with them. It's not like making a large mark. I mean, I wouldn't mind writing a bestseller, but you wouldn't write books about non-dual spirituality if you want a bestseller. So I feel really good about that. There's a lot of art integrity in that work. And this most recent book is a collection of short stories. So it feels great to have my fiction out there. You know, obviously I think one of the main vectors is about love and connection. And I feel really, when I reflect on that, I feel a lot of gratitude. And another vector is making an impact. And I've definitely felt as though, you know, in almost all of the work that I've done, there's been that eye toward, you know, whether it's the Bodhisattva vow or just trying to leave the world a little better.
Have you taken the Bodhisattva vow and in what tradition?
Jews are afraid of vows. And
nobody told me that.
Oh yeah, no. There's even a prayer Yom Kippur every day, holiest day in the Jewish calendar, annulling any vows that you might have taken.
No.
It came earlier, but it became popular in the time of forced conversions when Jews were being forced to convert to Christianity. And although, again, this legal formula had existed beforehand, it became very widespread. And now, you know, in like the jazz singer where he sings Kol Nidre, as he sings that, that's the annulling of vows. It's funny because that tune is very moving and the language is legalistic. It's literally like a legal absolution. Wow. For many vows that you'd taken. So no, I haven't. I come through the insight tradition. I'm authorized to teach in Venerable Ayakima's tradition, which is a Sri Lankan, you know, kind of Theravadan tradition. I teach jhana. Lee Brasington was my teacher. And I got ordained as a rabbi by my Jewish meditation teacher, Rabbi David Cooper of blessed memory. He and his wife were my first Jewish meditation teachers. So that's those lineages.
How did Jews meditate?
What's that?
How did Jews meditate? Nobody ever told me about that when I was growing up.
Yeah, no, it's not quite what you get in Sunday school. In different ways, you know, there are... I'm using this word advisedly also, like indigenous Jewish meditation practices. And it's advised both because, you know, I don't know if that word applies, but also all Jewish contemplative practices touch other ones, right? They were influenced either by Sufism or by ancient Babylonian contemplative techniques. So they're in the Bible, they're in the Talmud, they're in later literature, and they really flower in the 19th century in the Hasidic movement. But they're all influenced by other things. But then in the last, you know, 50 years or so, and I've written a lot about this actually in my work, a lot of what's now Jewish meditation is kind of a fusion of mindfulness and Jewish practices. Uh-huh. So in actually, when we're finished, I'm teaching a course for an online course for a place called the Institute for Jewish Spirituality. And it's actually on the Buddhist Jewish intersection. And that institute, which has done amazing work, has kind of a working definition of Jewish mindfulness. So that's how Jews meditate.
It also sounds like a great setup for a joke. You can Jewish
There's
mindfulness.
A couple of great books of I think it's called Zen Judaism.
Yeah.
So I'll give you one. I don't know if you've read them all, but you know, so in Zen, you want to divest yourself of all and all notions of the self, even of reality, form, emptiness. So what do you have left? Bupkis. Which is the Yiddish word for nothing. But it's a great Yiddish word that's hard to translate because it means nothing, but like, I got nothing. It's like specific.
Is that the Bupkis Sutra?
Oh, man, you should make a career of this. We could just tell jokes the whole time.
If it was up to me, I would. And my favorite people are comedians, actually.
That's a Wittgenstein teaching, that he imagined, the philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein imagined a religion composed entirely of jokes.
Oof, it depends who's telling them and who's taking the brunt of it.
Yeah, really. Not the like nasty racist jokes. Yeah, that's right.
Well, humor is a amazing thing. And my teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, used to say, if it isn't funny, if it doesn't have a sense of humor, it's not Buddhism. Have you ever heard anything like that?
Theravadins are dry people. That's not really true, but it was a good line.
There are a lot of great Zen jokes. I'm sure you know them.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think most koans are really jokes.
A Vajrayana joke, I have to think about more. I have to contemplate what that would look like. But are you a happy person?
It depends what you mean by happy. Actually, I should have done the Jewish version. You know, Jews answer a question with a question. So I should have said, who's asking?
Right.
Yeah. I think, we're recording this in a challenging period of time around the Israel and Gaza war. And so, for me to say I'm happy right now in the conventional sense would be not true. And also would feel kind of gross. I wrote a book of mine called The Gate of Tears, Sadness and the Spiritual Path. So that tells you what team I'm on. But that book ultimately is about joy. There's actually, this is a good little teaching to give over. There's a Hasidic, a Jewish teaching that comes, it's a verse, but it gets amplified that it's a great commandment or it's a great merit, a thing you should do to be happy always. And on the face of it, this is a obscene teaching, right? To be happy in war, happy in cancer wards, happy in the cemetery. It doesn't make sense on a conventional understanding of happiness.
It correlates exactly with the Lojong slogan.
What's the slogan?
Always rely on a joyful state of mind.
Right. So I think that's the key, is that it's joyful in that sense, as I understand the slogan, is not I'm just thinking happy thoughts or I'm right. Giddy with happiness. It's a joy it's the happiness that does not depend on conditions, right? It's the happiness of relinquishment, of letting go. Right. That is the one thing that is maybe not conditioned. And that, in that sense, I would describe myself as happy. Yes.
Right.
So that's why the Jewish joke of who's asking is really the right answer. It depends on a conventional level of happiness. Definitely no. And, I've struggled with that at times in my life, but I do think that my spiritual practice has enabled a deeper kind of happiness.
So what would you mean by unconditional, let's say, or free from cause and conditions? Which is,
I didn't mean to step in the philosophy hole. Yeah, I was just using it as a synonym for nibbana, for nirvana, the endless, undefinable letting go, which may or may not have something to do with the radiant, already awakened nature of mind itself. And I'm a Theravadin, but I dabble in. I'm a Dzogchen dabbler, and not just dabbler.
A lot of Dzogchen Theravadins around these days.
Yeah, there are. It's because we're so dry without it. It's like, what do I got this? I'm free from defilements. That's it. It's like, so that has both the Dzogchen teachings and the non-dual Jewish teachings more align with that view than with, let's say, more Theravadin or Hinayana Buddhist view has been very nourishing for me. And it also aligns with some insights that one can get on psychedelics, which has been a kind of an area of work for me in the last few years. I now have you can add to the pile of resume items. I'm a field scholar at the Emory Center for Psychedelics and Spirituality. and, you know, really trying to look at that intersection with more diligence and seriousness. Yeah.
So are you licensed to administer those?
I'm not. Yeah. No, my role in that center, so I have a PhD in Jewish thought, but in really in religious studies. And there's amazing, exciting work happening in that field. It's also not necessarily informed by a lot of religious studies scholarship and how we understand diverse religious traditions and the multiplicity of mystical experiences, for example, and how, you know, the Emory Center is also very, very concerned with standards of care. So people have these powerful psychedelic experiences, which we might see as positive, but which they might experience as a profound spiritual crisis. And there's not a lot of protocols yet for how to really work with that in different traditions that people might be coming from. And in being a little bit more sensitive and attentive to how we describe the plurality of psychedelic experiences and the plurality of mystical and spiritual experiences. So that is like a really fun new area for me. And
In both cases, the notion of breaking through some kind of, like, I guess, dark night of the soul or... you know, going through some kind of challenging experience to achieve any level of realization. Would you hold that view that that's necessary? Somebody who's going to have to face that at some point rather than just skip their way into...
It's been my experience. It's been the experience of every teacher I know. Yeah. And, you know, even what you or I don't know, what I might consider a part of the peak experience could be could be experienced as a crisis. So you see, let's say that the myths of your religious tradition. So I'm obviously poly multipath, but suppose I'm not that. Suppose I'm a more conservative Christian and I receive some sort of psychedelics in a medical environment. And I see that the myths that my tradition holds dear are only one of many and that everything is really, there's many forms of the divine. Jay would regard that as great, right? But somebody in that position might be profoundly disturbed. And there are really wonderful accounts already in the literature of people saying things like that. So the dark night, right? But also even the light after the dark night can be really challenging for folks depending on their religious backgrounds and what myths they hold dear. So what's exciting about this whole field is like there is this initial phase of enthusiasm. I think we're maybe a little after that, but we're still at this very early stage of researchers and others doing some really good work. There's really great work happening in the Dharma community and in the Jewish community and in several Christian communities. And so it's an exciting new, I felt like, that list you gave was not full enough. So I wanted to add some more diverse, seemingly unrelated activities to the pile.
Well, seemingly being the active.
Related. That one's related. Yeah.
What do you ever think? What will I be in 5 years? Do you think like that at all? Like, where am I going?
It's funny. I think I'm 52 now. I think when I was around 40, I realized that like everybody but me seemed to be thinking that way. but not even 20, you know, so I went to law school and I went to Yale Law School, right? So filled with like lots of overachievers. One current US senator was in a class one below me, so many famous law professors. And I did, you know, they were thinking 20 years ahead, right? And, you know, where do I want to be? They were thinking at 25, you know, where do I want to be at 50? And for me, at that point in my life, you know, I was in the closet at that point, and I was cut off, not just from my like romantic or sexual desires, but from any desire, from any understanding of myself in the world. It like my whole life seemed to be happening to somebody else. And I was just cut off. I think folks might not, people have diverse experiences of the closet and some people don't have any experience of it in the queer community. But for me, you know, there was really this, I just couldn't envision myself in 10 years. You know, everything about that seemed to be somebody else's life. Like I'd be married to a woman with children and I'd be living this life. Like none of that seemed to make any sense. And then, you know, I came out a little bit late. I was 29, 30 years old. And then there was this whole period of exploration. My 30s were just this wonderful opening of spiritual and sexual exploration and sensual exploration. That's when I started going to Burning Man those 14 times, almost every year in my 30s. And, you know, I'm really grateful that I had those years. A lot of people have them in their 20s, but, you know, I still had those. And it was only a little bit later that I could start to even think about your question. Now I do think about it. I have a 5-year-old daughter, and you know, I'm in a different phase of life now where, yeah, I mean, I'm financially planning for 5 to 15, 20 years from now, let alone just envisioning it. But even now, I think the degree to which the financial planning is pretty solid, actually, but the degree to which, like, exactly where I'll be in my work, it's hard to go beyond 5 years out, whereas I know a lot of people do.
If you took all the projects you're working on now, would one arise phoenix-like to the top of the pile? Is there something that you're invested in now that you're doing that is, like, you know, has more weight for you personally?
So my immediate answer is like, oh, if I didn't have to think about money, you know, I just write all the time. And I love my books and I love my journalistic writing. You know, that's like the immediate answer. And yet, even as I say that, I'm mindful of something I said about 10 minutes ago, that there are just, I'm happiest when there's a balance in my work life of these different activities. So, you know, if I were just writing, I think I would miss the connection, the Dharma connection. So, you know, I'm on the leadership team of New York Insight, the New York Insight Meditation Center, and there's a 3-person leadership team. I'm one of those people. And, you know, I love that. I love being able, I love it in a certain way, even more than teaching, because I kind of get to be the DJ of a lot of different teachers, diverse teachers who can speak to people from different backgrounds, diverse in every way, tradition as well as background. And that's really exciting and fun. And I did some of that at 10% Happier for a while too, where I was kind of curating a section of short mini Dharma talks, like 5 to 10 minute mini Dharma talks. And there are some talks that I can't give, you know, or not with any integrity. And so it's, I do love that piece. And yet when I'm only doing that work, I get really itchy. The creative side isn't quite as nourished, and also the activist side. You know, I feel like there's a place in the world both for, I see meditation as kind of one of many forms of long-term activism, like really trying to see if we can get inside the human mind and help us be a little gentler to each other, maybe in some way. But there's also for me a real pull to short-term activism, to finding suffering and working to lessen it in the world as we find it.
And in that zone, like, just who do you feel are the most important teachers in the world right now within that zone?
In that exact overlap zone, like the engaged Buddhist?
Not engaged, but just Buddhist, you know, like, whether it's engaged or not, maybe that's an important element of it for you. But like, is there anybody that you look at and go like, that is, that the work that person is doing is extremely important and relevant for a wide swath at the moment? Like, who's your hero?
I'm thinking of like whole groups of people, like the Zen peacemakers. You know, maybe Bernie Glassman was one, you know, would have been one of those heroes in that way. But I also think of folks who are working in communities under extreme stress, either with prisoner populations, people who are incarcerated, or with communities that historically haven't had access to meditation. And so I don't know that there's one, you know, like, this is the dude, you know, like, I want to be Matthew Ricard, although he's one of those people, right? I think he's sitting at this juncture of Dharma and activism and has leveraged a certain degree of fame to do a lot of good, you know? But I don't know, I don't know if there's that one. I'd have to think more about that. But I think there are these groups of folks who are doing that. And I do think that there is a space. I think we're at a really early phase of integrating Dharmic wisdom with the political world. You know, one of the people doing that is someone who I don't really love, which is Marianne Williamson. Nothing personal or anything like that. I just like the way she teaches. It's not like my style. I'm not really judging. It's just like for me personally. But, you know, that project is something that I find really appealing. But it's challenging. I think one of the things she struggles with is, you know, the way she teaches gets seen as sort of, well, that's new age and that's marginal. And so that's weird. And let's not even talk about that. And that's really a shame, because a lot of what she's saying about the core, a lot of our core struggles are between a politics of fear and the capacities of the human heart and human mind to love. I actually think that's accurate, but it's so hard to give that over in a way that can be heard by large numbers of people. that I almost look to folks who do that within Christian traditions. Obviously, Dr. King is like the, you know, paragon of having done that, you know, really calling on our spiritual traditions for justice. But there are others too. And it's, I don't think anyone's really solved how to do that really effectively.
Well, what comes through fairly clearly is the interface between contemplative practice and engaged activism seems to be your sweet spot.
Yeah, there's something like that. Yeah. Although I also, you know, speak that I use the phrase code switching before. You know, the cliche render unto Caesar what is Caesar and render unto God what is God. Jesus said it, right? Not a really cliche biblical utterance. And, you know, I've been trying just in the last few years, like when I'm on CNN, I was on last night for a segment, you know, trying to bring in the ethical and even, I don't use the word spiritual, but the ethical and spiritual aspects of our political moment. But it's hard to do that, you know, and a lot of what I write on the journalism side might not look very quote unquote spiritual to folks, because when it doesn't do that. So it's the interface, but it's almost a juxtaposition as much as an interface.
When Ethan was, he went to Brown, my son Ethan, who you know, went to Brown, and it was kind of surprising to me. He studied economics. So there was he was incredibly gifted at math. Mm. He was at a very young age, he could do all kinds of equations in his head. And I said, well, Ethan, if you want to like help the world figure out an economic system that works, that has its foundation in some kind of practicality, but also ethical system. So, yeah, he didn't really take me that seriously about that challenge.
but that's also but, part of it, too. I mean, look, you know, if you look at the polarization right now in our country, the partisan polarization, it's kind of bizarre. If humans were rational, none of this would be happening, right? But, you know, Republicans tend to be able to speak to a lot of the spiritual and emotional frustrations and malaise that, you know, a lot of, especially white Americans feel, right? And that is real, right? The way they speak to it, maybe not, but that feeling and the feeling of loss of status, which might be loss of privilege, but still the experience and the economic loss that the middle class has suffered, ironically, is due to the Republican policies of the last half century. And yet it's the Republicans who are having much more success at speaking to those deep aspects of the mind and heart. And so, you know, there are so few, you know, people who are able to speak to those qualities, but with a more, with an economic program that would actually help, right? So it's like, you know, the conservatives are good at like, they do economics that help the elites and rhetoric that speak to the masses. The Democrats are good at economics that help the masses of people, but they're not good. But they speak to the elites. They don't, right? And they're, you know, I follow Robert Reich, you know, former labor secretary on social media. He's very good at it. There are a lot of folks who are good at it. Pete Buttigieg is actually really good at it. But as a general rule, it's this really frustrating thing. So maybe we should get Ethan a new job and he can just run for president and be the guy who, even if we don't have the new economic system, it's the ability to join a diagnosis of where America is spiritually and emotionally and culturally with a remedy that would actually work. It's this bizarre situation, I think, since Reagan, you know, for the last 40 years, where the policies that would actually help economically are being rejected by the people they would help.
In addition to the economic piece, there's a leadership hierarchical structure, which I've been totally fascinated in my life, even just building companies, but also at the bigger scale. You know, what do you have any like guiding principles that you would use to apply to a leadership structure, to a government? Like how should it be structured? I know it's kind of a big question, but I think that way, you know, this isn't really working completely what we have.
No, you don't think?
No.
Things seem to be going really well.
I'm optimistic, basically, but, you know, it seems like there's some glitches in the, you know.
Yeah, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not actually an organizational systems guy. And I'm aware of that having worked in larger organizations, which have gone both right and wrong. In smaller organizations, working at a meditation center, for example, we have a shared leadership model that I think is more appropriate to that kind of small and spiritually minded organization. But it definitely feels as though there is, where I am focused is on anytime there's an intersection of either psychology or behavioral science or spirituality or religion and the way people vote and think about politics. There's a book about 20 years ago called The Political Brain. I think Drew Weston is his name, who's still around. He's actually doing good podcasting work. Just noticing, there was an older book called What's the Matter with Kansas by Thomas Frank, which sort of said what I said before, but it had almost a little condescending element to it. It's like, why are these dumb people in Kansas voting against their economic interests? Don't they? They're all being hoodwinked by Ronald Reagan or something. Well, that's not quite right. I mean, there's as The Political Brain shows, there's reasons why people trust leaders and don't trust leaders. And they have very little to do with policy positions. And they're choosing based on a lot of inchoate stuff. And, I think as people on the left scratch our heads about how anybody could vote for Donald Trump, it's worth asking them, right? And some of it is a kind of dark cult of personality, and some of it is a kind of white grievance and nihilism, really, like a sense that we've lost America and the we is this formerly very privileged white male-centered power apparatus. But part of it is also a kind of real dislocation about globalization and about technology and things that are real and changes in gender norms, that are insufficiently explained or humanized, and plenty of other factors as well. So I'm less personally, I feel less qualified to talk about the systems, but more obsessed with the brains that come together in those systems. So you tell me, how should we reform?
Well, not to oversimplify it, but you have your top-down kind of structures, right, which can be either autocratic or more principled. And then you have your kind of, flat-level systems. I'm sort of leaning towards a model. Like, I'm building a company called Dharma Moon, and I deliberately didn't make it a nonprofit. It's a public benefit corporation, but it's we have to make money to survive, and I can't just ask people for like donations and gifts.
Right.
So that's a new model, and it goes with the creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. What model could we use to create some kind of society, really? I think we're rebuilding society from the inside out right now. That's what I feel.
I think that's right. I don't know if I have a similarly revolutionary vision for society, but I do think that the people in that society are that way. But, back on thinking about Dharma Moon, so I did work at 10% Happier for several years, and there's sort of a built-in structural problem, I think, to yoga organizations, or yoga companies, meditation companies, et cetera, which is an endless dance, which 10%, I think, did pretty skillfully, certainly, while I was there, between, integrity to the tradition and what people want, right? And we've seen plenty of examples of places that haven't had that level of integrity, right? But it's always that push-pull, right? So if what really helps is deeper work, for example, but people have to be persuaded that that's the case because they don't think that's true. They're like, I'm stressed out and I need to relax. And so, another app that's out there in the world, Calm, has had a little bit more success because that's just what they offer, right? They don't offer how to be a better person or how to wake up in your life or how to see through, right? It's just like, here's how to calm down. And I think that's intrinsic to, I don't know, whatever we want to call that space. I hesitate to use the word wellness because that's kind of a gross word now, but whatever that space is, it's because it's very hard to convince people to buy a product that they don't think they need. It's hard enough to convince them to buy a product that they do think they need, right? Like our soap is better than the other soap, but they know they need soap. But when we're selling Dharma, and I'm not criticizing, it should be clear, I'm sure there are plenty of people who'd be like, how dare you start a for? That's not my line at all. I noticed firsthand like this tension between, the consumer wants a short-term fix. to their problem. And their problem is real. I'm not mocking that, right? They're suffering. And we did some of our best work at 10%, you know, in COVID, right? Where people were really suffering. And we could offer a lot of short-term relief. And it was enormously fulfilling. And at the same time, you know, I think, I suspect you think that the practices that lead to more, that deeper transformation aren't those short-term things. And yet convincing folks to do, to spend money on that is hard.
Yeah, it's, of course, I'm sure that it must have happened at 10% happier that somebody made a deal like, how about 9.5% for you, special offer. Did that not come up?
I will say, I think Dan Harris's title, I think, was like the most brilliant thing, right? Because precisely, and maybe the opposite of what I just said, but not really. Like, if there's, you know, people have this idea of like meditation, like, okay, I'm going to be, find my Zen and I'm going to be calm. And if I'm not doing that, I'm doing it wrong. And, you know, Dan's book, which is about number one bestseller, and then the company, you know, and the podcast, was just so smart, I think, about saying, well, would you do a lot of work if you could get 10% happier? Like, forget the 100% people. Even though Dan is, by the way, personally obsessed with the 100% people, like he's chasing around, like he's like, where are the enlightened people and can I interview them? Which is interesting. But, you know, for most folks, and a lot of folks, I think, said yes to that proposition. Like, yeah, all right, I'll give you an hour a day or something. If that makes me 10% less of a jerk, 10% less stressed, 10% kinder, and 10% happier. I just thought that was a stroke of genius. I'm not paid to say that. I don't get 10% of royalties.
85% or I'm not in. Has he had Matthew Ricard on his show?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. We've certainly talked about him a lot. Yeah. What's that? Yeah, he's one of the enlightened ones. He has a whole idea that he wants to do this as a project, like go around and meet the enlightened folks. And but I think it actually is a bit, it leads to the deeper question, which is a fun, profound question, which is, you know, what we mean. What do we mean by enlightenment? And I think it's an interesting also to get in the weeds for a second, because it might be fun for you and me, even if no one else. You know, in the Theravadan / Hinayana model of enlightenment, I think actually depends on a lot of causes and conditions, you know, including something that looks like monasticism. And you could definitely get 10%, you can get maybe 50%, maybe even more happier and better and, you know, and enlightened in daily life. But that model and that frame of what enlightenment is requires a lot of conditions and work. And there are other models in the Dharma, you know, the Vajrayana one is one of them, that has a different understanding of enlightenment. And so you can walk around and meet lots of enlightened people because there's a different conception of what that means. I once wrote an article too about like what's Jewish enlightenment. I was really interested in that subject. And that one has a lot more, it's neither the Theravada model nor, as I understand it, the Vajrayana model, but it's one of, it's not a steady state that seems, because Judaism has hardly any monastic tradition in it whatsoever, only really on the fringes, definitely not anywhere near the center. It's a householder religion. The, you know, the observance of the commandments, which is paramount in traditional Judaism, requires you to be in a family environment and in a householder life. And so it's much more about being able to access what they would call like expanded mind or God's point of view quickly. So, and running and returning, going back and forth from our ordinary mind, which they don't denigrate, but which they just say is one way of seeing, and this other way of seeing where everything is God and everything is one. And we can see from that perspective and live in that, embodied in that way, and then go back because you can't live in that way in their model. You can't live in that way. And also, you know, have 9 kids in your shtetl house.
Cannot
in that model. The idea is that you can have the consciousness of the divine before you always, right? And yet it's not, even then the conception of it is like quickly coming back. So you're in the mortgage and then you shift back, and it can be as quick as that gesture, right? But it's like that. Yeah.
Well, this is probably one of our favorite little Dharma bundles, is the absolute and relative truth.
Right.
And then for those who follow that perspective, there's a third truth, which is the inseparability of absolute and relative truth is a third truth, which to me, that is a very interesting perspective. Now, you just said you're shifting from one perspective to the other, so that it's not a blended reality at that point. Is that, do I understand you correctly?
That's the way, that's that model. And I think what's happened in my life is that I was really interested when I wrote that book, Everything is God. There's like a big chart in there between the relative and the absolute and the non-duality of the relative and the absolute. And I found in practice, I was full of shit.
That's a good chapter title.
Yeah.
In practice, and I was full of shit.
In theory, yes.
Yeah.
Right. I was in the view, you know, and, you know, it was the tantric unification of relative and absolute. And, you know, it was the wetness of the waves and every wave is wet and all of those things. And in practice, I was full of shit. You know, I was immersing in things that I was experiencing suffering as suffering, not experiencing it as both suffering and also the wetness of the wave. So I'm not like, I don't disagree, like, you know, but it's like, as I operationalized it in my life, which sounds more conscious than it was, like it didn't. And I kept like reinforcing that. Yeah. Like I was really nourished by that perspective. And like I said, it's in the book. Like I was all about it. And, so I was like, well, this too is God. This too is God. This too is. And then I like kind of just realized, like I was falling too much into that space of, you know, it's where the guy in Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance finds himself, right? Where he has that breakdown, like everything is quality, right? So you can just sit in your own shit and vomit and, you know, whatever, and never bathe because everything is quality, right? That's his word for the, you know, and I wasn't in that extreme situation, but I was in a situation where I wasn't doing the relative world things that could be helpful for shifting the mind state on a relative level. And so I started getting more interested in these more oscillating models of awakening.
And that correlates too with, it's interesting, you know, Abhidharma, the actual, you know, clinical analysis of how the mind actually works in time. You know, the idea being that there's about 120 mental frames per second.
Right.
And that it is digital, the mind, the experience is digital rather than analog, rather than flowing through. And so it would be a very quick flickering of different experiences. And maybe also noticing the fact that they're not continuous is another aspect of the experience, is actually experiencing the discontinuity of it.
Right.
As non-conceptual kind of flicker. So doesn't it come down at some point to experience the realm of experience of like being, and maybe the psychedelics are interesting there, of being put into a perspective in which you can't apply your ordinary perspective. It doesn't work in wherever you are.
Yeah, great minds think alike. I was just about to make a similar point. I think, you know, as my own practice life evolved in parallel with all the rest of my life that we haven't talked about, which is fine. You know, that's one reason I got really interested in jhana. So jhanas, for folks who don't know, are these meditative absorptions that could be cultivated, and they're extremely wonderful bliss states. And I feel like stating my credibility to talk about bliss states, like I've had a lot of really great bliss states. It's been a great role. You know, I talked about my being a gay man in my 30s. There's a lot of bliss states. I've had a lot of them, and including also meditation bliss states and states that are quite profound, extreme, you know, concentration and real unitive experiences and things like that. The jhanas, you know, are maybe take the cake as far as experience, such that you start getting less attached to experiences because they're so, you know, it takes so much cake that you're kind of like, well, okay, this is another experience. And that's like the most profound experience you've had in your life. And I found those helpful, again, partly because I'm an Enneagram 7 and indulgent, but more seriously because there's like the touching into those states of mind. The mind learns those ways of experiencing, and such that it becomes possible to touch into them often. And that, from a sort of purely, I would say, tantric point of view, unifying relative and absolute, it can seem like maybe a waste of time. Like, why are you just having more relative experiences? That's silly. But again, in my actual life, having those relative experiences enables me to touch into the absolute in the midst of daily life. And that's especially true with I would call it the kind of dharmic use of psychedelics. So obviously the experience itself, especially if it's a long experience, has its own teaching. And also you know, it's possible to train the mind to remember. Now, I won't say, I want to say with a capital R, but like, you know, to really remember because of the kind of power of those experiences. And, you know, so for me, I mean, one of the medicines that's not as well known is the toad medicine, 5-MeO-DMT. And the experience on that in particular is completely immersive, completely dissociative, and complete ego death. And it really is extremely profound. It's hard to describe it. In fact, it's impossible to describe it. And after doing it enough, it's possible to kind of remember little echoes or shadows of it. And that is a big part of my practice, you know, because I do have a 5-year-old child who I did raise through the pandemic. And, you know, it's not possible. I haven't gone on a more than a 2-day meditation retreat in 6 years. Mm. And I used to go on retreats all the time. I did, you know, 3-month retreats, 2-month retreats. And, you know, that's just not going to happen right now, given what I perceive as my commitments to my family. And so having these other ways of connecting in short bits to that kind mm-hmm. of peak experience has been enormously valuable for me.
I wonder what the toad experience is like.
We don't really lick the toad. This medicine
the toad turns into a prince.
No, yeah.
And you get high. No, but seriously,
does the toad
have any impact from what it's carrying in itself?
Apparently not. It's actually, so most 5-MeO-DMT is now synthesized. It occurs naturally in a grass, actually, a sort of tall grass. And it's extracted from that and processed. So not quite synthesized. It's coming from a natural source, but not from the toad. It's actually a toad venom that the toad does not itself experience. No, it's funny because it's a really ordinary frog. I mean, it's a toad. I know frogs and toads are different. It's a toad. It's just this Sonoran toad that is not very common. It's actually now slightly endangered, partly because of all these white people going down there and licking its back all the time. So it's better to use the plant-based version.
Let's face it, white people are really nuts. Can we just say that on the air?
I would just say we're used to a certain level of entitlement that causes us to mess up other places.
Lick toads, you know, I mean, really.
Well, it does. There is some record. It's actually interesting. Unlike, let's say, ayahuasca, where there's a very rich indigenous tradition, there's not nearly as much or information, at least that we know of. Now there are indigenous groups in the area of the Sonoran Desert who do use this medicine, but it's a curious fact that there's just not as rich a tradition as there's, you know, with ayahuasca. There's tons of art. There's just a lot that goes back at least hundreds of
culture.
Years.
It's a bit of a culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a weird fact about this that it's not nearly as, well, it may be there and it may just be secret and we white people may not know about it. I don't know.
So when you mentioned Dan wanting to meet the 100% folks, I mean, you know, our lineage springs forth from the Mahasiddhas. That's really, you trace it right back to that kind of yogic freelance, you know, then it cooked up with the monastic tradition quite a bit later on and got carried through the monastic tradition. But don't you think there are Mahasiddhas around these days? Do you think there are those
people? I don't know.
Really highly realized, accomplished people, but maybe you don't know.
There clearly are. You know, I've been in the presence of a few over the years. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, I think I think it does depend a little bit on the definition again. You know, if it's that tantric definition, meaning both absolute and relative held at the same time and recognized two sides of the same inexplicable reality. Yeah, there's a lot of those folks. I'm not sure that it depends so there's a Theravadan guy by the name of Daniel Ingram. He's an American guy who claims to be an arhant, but his definition of the arhant is different from the traditional one. So it's like, well, it doesn't necessarily impact your ethical conduct the way that the texts say, and you can still have X or Y or Z. Well, that's fine. That's just a different definition of realized or enlightened. You know, I mean, Ramesh Balsekar seems to have been very realized and enlightened, but had some very questionable romantic entanglements with some of his students. Mm-hmm. Was he realized but also unethical? You know, according to some models, those can coexist, right? So that's why I think it's like a definitional thing. I've rarely met people who it seemed to me are incapable of ethical wrong action. I won't say never, but that to me seems harder than meeting people who have had profound and enduring experiences such that their consciousness is forever awakened. Yeah.
You know, just on this topic, one of the people who comes to my mind is Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, mm-hmm. who was, you know, had the opportunity to spend considerable time there. And as far as I'm concerned, as far as I could, my capability of perceiving it, inseparable from whatever you would want to talk about in terms of realization or Buddhahood or something like that. Mm-hmm. Completely like Bank of England level of, you know, stability and kind of kindness you know, multidimensionality. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting to see this, to be as old as I am, first of all, is interesting anyhow, period. 75 is just like, yeah, it all happened already, right? And now is it going to happen again, or is this going to be something new? Mm. So I wonder, you know, what we're all doing now. It feels, and that's why coming back to Dharma Moon, the geodesic dome was what I arrived at for this sort of, rather than the pyramid or the ladder. Uh-huh. And maybe it's being a little bit of a Taoist, but things organize themselves into spherical situations in which the hierarchy can move around sometimes by the implication that wisdom is manifesting in a particular situation, therefore spontaneously communicating with the situation that's less processed. So, you know, that idea that you wouldn't have as much linear orientation going into it. You'd have to enter a world of spheres, circles, things that are not linear to really relate to it. Does that make any sense at all? That was a little bit of a jam, but...
No, I get it. I'm just thinking of nonprofit meetings that I have attended that last for 3 hours because consensus is required, and it just makes me...
Yeah, miserable. But I'm not talking... That's a flat circle.
I see.
That's not a dome. That's the difference, is that in whatever situation that is, somebody should rise to the top of that and have a higher perspective, an organizational perspective, which is the nonprofit is kind of, to me, a flattened out perspective of, you know, enforced democracy. You don't recognize brilliance in it necessarily. Would you say?
Yeah. I'm an introvert. I'm an INTJ. In fact, if we switch from Enneagram to Myers-Briggs, and so I'm aware of my own limitations in this regard.
I wonder what I am. I have. Well, you know, Susan Piver is an Enneagram.
Yeah.
You know, and I forgot even what number she said I am. I it's so hard for me to think that way.
Yeah. I mean, what I love about the Enneagram, Susan takes it a little more mystically than I do, actually. And mm-hmm. we've had mm-hmm. lovely conversations, the two of us about it. But for me, I like it. I like that it's like the horoscope based on data as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, something that, and I like that it's just data driven. You know, you can take a 200 question quiz or something and really get in there. And
wow.
I found it useful in relationship. I'm married to mm-hmm. a nine. That's really good to understand. And the nine is like the peacemaker. Who's really good at getting along with people. Sevens are not. I'm not very good at getting along, but he really is. But there's pitfalls to that too, right? And I found it useful. I just find it useful. And
is there anything like the amp and Spinal Tap that goes up to 11?
Actually, somebody did just make that joke. It was funny. Like I just read something like the Enneagram that goes to 9. I'm probably an 11. So that's a nice synchronicity that happened. But I do find it. I find it also helpful. You know, one of the, I haven't really seen this connection made a lot, but the way we now think about neurodiversity for me ties in with the Enneagram, that there are different, just a lot of different talents and people who might have been stigmatized for not having certain abilities, but may well have other abilities that are incredibly valuable, not just like autistic savants or something like that, but just people with different attributes and different things to contribute. I like that sort of, speaking of round, you know, the nine types are usually put in a circle. I like that model that all of these different personalities and personality types can really be of value to the individual and the group. And so it's a matter of understanding them more. That for me is really, I find true and also really helpful.
And what about intuitive? Is you're a seven, did you say?
Yeah. The seven is like the sensualist or the, the hedonist or whatever, but it's not only on the physical sensual level. Like, it's also like, you know, people who like jhana tend to be a lot of sevens, right? Because it's like about experience.
You're looking for experiences,
right? Whereas, let's say a one might be a little bit more about order, religion, ethics, you know, things like that. I mean, obviously, as we've talked about, I'm interested in ethics, but you know, I think my daughter might be turning into a one, which is a little scary to watch, because they tend to, the ones on the shadow side are like the fascists, right? These are the people who want a lot of order. But the one on the healthy side is also just someone who's really good at order. Or creating spaces of order and having things, you know, together and having groups get along well, you know, and organized in such a way. Even your model with like the dome and not a pyramid, you know, just that way of thinking, which I don't really have, can be associated with that personality type. All of these have healthy and unhealthy manifestations, right? The unhealthy seven is right. Like, you know, your friends from the music industry who died, right? And, you know, yeah. who burned out or whatever. But the healthy versions are your friends of the music industry who have lived and who are now, you know, 80 and playing rock stadiums.
Yeah. I mean, Joni Mitchell comes to mind as like, right. She's been stunning lately.
Yeah. She's probably a three or four, but yeah.
Yeah.
She's more of a poet. Yeah.
But so I guess at the end of the day, what role does not knowing kind of play in how you schedule your day?
I would say it's pretty bounded in terms of how I schedule my day, because I'm actually pretty organized in a lot of ways, and I thrive from that. I mean, it does factor in the bounded way. You know, you never know where the moment of beauty is going to come from. I was just driving. I have a little motorcycle. I was driving here in town, and you know, it's fall season here in the northeastern United States, and beautiful leaves, and just a moment of just clarity. No big insight to report. Just the moment itself. You know, and the mind awake, radiant, the beautiful. You know, beautiful scenery, and just that conditions a certain quality of the mind. You know, so being open to that spontaneity, yeah. And not knowing when that's going to arise. Also, you know, again, we're right. I'm in this news cycle, and it's a grief process. And with grief processes, you know, my experience, I think almost everyone's, is you don't know what the day is going to be. Mm. Yesterday, I had a lot of anger for no reason I could really identify other than that I'm in this grief process. And I wasn't angry at any particular thing or person. What do you got? I'll be angry at it. You know, like, is that Brando, right? What are you rebelling against? He says, what do you got? Is that him or James Dean?
Maybe James Dean. I don't know. Yeah.
Come on, I'm giving you boomer references. You're supposed to, that's like.
Okay, boomer. That's what Ethan says. Okay, boomer.
I didn't know. I didn't say okay. I didn't meet the person who invented that phrase. So yeah, I think there's that openness, but at the same time for me, you know, I've got my New York Insight work here. I've got the new book that I'm failing to promote on this podcast over here. You know, I've got the side hustle there. So it's the journalism work, which I'm doing very intensively right now because of the news cycle. So
let's not fail to promote your new book.
I always fail to promote.
No.
We talked about spirituality a lot. Right. We did a little bit making a book, but creativity, right. You know, so for me, this book is called The Secret That Is Not a Secret, 10 Heretical Tales. It's interlocking short stories on themes of mysticism, desire, and magic. And I, like a lot of nonfiction writers, you know, I sort of have always regarded myself as a failed novelist or a failed fiction writer. I have written two unpublished novels. I don't think either will ever really see the light of day. But these stories, the original version of them, you know, go back 15 years. They weren't really ripe in a certain way. You know, I wrote them as my, it was actually a very early version, was my MFA thesis at Sarah Lawrence, because I have an MFA in fiction writing. And, but I've always been really proud of them. And now, so they've been completely rewritten. Some have been taken out, new ones put in, some just completely, you know, top to bottom redone. And it really encapsulates where I'm at creatively and spiritually in a way of nothing else that I've done. And so I'm super excited about it. It's with an independent press called Ayin, A-Y-I-N Press. Probably not going to sell a gajillion copies, but as a...
Don't say that.
It's going to sell a jillion copies. I'm going to manifest
You do not want to miss out on this book, friends.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, what okay. I was going to say is, however many copies it sells, I think it will really resonate with some people. Yeah. And that's the kind of relationship that I'm looking at now, wanting for these books to have with readers.
And can you say the name again for
The Secret That Is Not a Secret.
Ooh.
Which we were talking, you're one of the few people, you're going to get it immediately, right? Because we were just talking about the unification of relative and absolute. So it's the secret, but it's actually not a secret.
Is it out?
It is, publication date is December 5th, 2023.
Okay, perfect. And available in all the usual ways?
Available in all the usual places. If you want the hyper-capitalist place, they have it. If you want
alternative, what about audio?
We will have an audiobook, which I am recording in 2 weeks from this moment. I'm going to go into the studio, record it myself.
I was going to beseech you to do that if you weren't going to do that.
Oh, thanks for the beseechment.
Yeah, beseeching, because books read by other people, it's not a happening thing, at least as far as I'm concerned. But by the author, if the author takes the time and care, it's another way of getting into the author's being.
Well, I told you, but I haven't told, listeners, that your non-audiobook of Midnight Gospel, changed my life in the pandemic. So that was like my favorite. that TV show was the only show that I felt accurately represented the reality of March 2020. And for folks who haven't seen it, of course, it's a dystopian animated high level of gore fantasy. And that seemed like a good mirror on the world at the time. It was the only thing I could watch. I couldn't watch anything else.
Our wonderful friend Duncan Trussell, who put that together. He's got a unique perspective, these days. I find he's one of my go-tos for like, what's going on? I have other people I call for what the fuck call, like what the fuck is going on here, because it's just like incomprehensible. Right. But there's something going on in a shaping of, I heard a great phrase from a friend, like, you know what a midlife crisis is?
Yeah.
Have you heard this one? A quarterly crisis?
I have heard that. But so do you get one of those now? Are you at quarter?
No, I'm three. I'm probably 7/8. But
I thought you got 3/4. No, we're good. You get to live to 100. That's the point.
Well, we'll see about that. But the quarterly one is like at 25. Uh-huh. The midlife is like 50. It's a crisis of who am I? What is it going to be? Yeah. How are we going to do it? And we have a lot of people like that in our ecosystem, which I love, because that's a great time of life.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because one of those two unpublished novels is exactly about that. 18 careers ago, I was in the first dot-com boom. I did start a startup in 2000 and was kind of front row seat to the crazy circus of that period. And sometimes literally a circus, like circus performers at at conventions and stuff like that. And the novel was set at that time. And it was exactly like, it felt to me like a period, there are plenty of adolescent novels, right? And plenty of coming of age novels, but this felt like this passage that wasn't captured a lot. Since then, I mean, I wrote that a million years ago. I think there have been a lot of good entries in that field, but I agree. Yeah, no, there is that. And there really is a generational shift. And I think I'm on your side of the shift at this point. When I was 22, mm-hmm. I could really write my ticket. I mean, I was very privileged, right? I graduated from Columbia, I decided to go to law school, but, people were exiting, going right from undergraduate to these, fancy management consulting things. And this was the 90s. So we were concerned. We were like, those sellouts, they suck, right? Because they're sellouts.
Right.
Because we had the sort of economic security to not be sellouts, right? Mm. And it really is different for Gen Z now. And when you look at the lower degree of economic opportunity,
sure,
the higher possibility of serious climate catastrophe in their lifetime. And, it's very fashionable for some boomers, but I'll just say for Gen X to be like, oh, you delegate this or that or the other, but millennials, but certainly Gen Z seem very aware of how screwed over they are. Millennials having gone through 9/11, 2008, COVID, and who knows what the current moment might lead to. And Gen Z looking at I feel like a 25-year-old person today faces such a different world from the world that I faced. Also, of course, the internet. You know, I was 25. The internet had just come out in wider usage. I remember getting my first email address. I was 24. I told my mother, by the way, to invest in Amazon at the IPO. And she said she likes buying books in a bookstore. So she didn't buy any of that stock. You know, it's such a different time that it feels like if I ever go back to that book, it's set in its time, and it's almost a time capsule from that totally different period.
Well, going forward on your book, I think you should think, could it be adapted to any kind of multimedia, you know, video or television or film or something like that?
I think, I mean, it's these connected short stories. We're looking at various kinds of visual media. The press is, it's fun being at an indie press because, you know, they're small, but super creative and right, energized. And I have a screenplay that was just getting shopped around that I'm super excited mm-hmm. about. And I think actually it was one of my publishers at this press, an artist named Eden Perlstein, who used to be a rapper under the name E Prime. So he still rhymes everything. He called my life Operation Bifurcation, which was to say there was like, you know, this creative work. I hear what I appreciate the positive thinking around the short story collection. I'm also mindful of the usual sales of short story collections, you know, but it feels really connected for me. Like I'm not just saying it to try to sell the book. Obviously it's just like, it really does. This is my Torah. This is my Dharma. You know, it's queer and it's sensual and it's heretical and it's juicy and it's all these different characters, and that gets me going. And I am really proud of it. And, you know, yeah, like whether it was the financial side hustle or some of the other work that I'm yeah. doing to make that sustainable, you know, that also feels connected. It's in the service yeah. of having the space to do that creative work. And I remember yeah. too, like it used to be, we used to hide our side hustles 25 years ago, but nowadays yeah. with the economy the way it is, it's like, you know, we're not Airbnb-ing our house, but I will help, you know, nonprofits get a tax credit because that's yeah. in the service of living. I'm still stuck with Seize the Day. You know, it's living in a way that feels authentic and heartful and hopefully helpful.
Well, Jay, on that note, first of all, I just want to say it was so lovely to get to know you a little bit. And the explosion of creativity coming out of you is just kind of apparent. Ordinary and dramatic all at the same time. And, I think people will be fortunate to come in contact with you and get a chance to enter any one of those portals in your geodesic dome that enables them to ripen. The Dharma piece is interesting. You know, I like to talk Dharma. You know, it's kind of, it gets a little nerdy for maybe some people, but for me, it's bread and butter. I don't think of these conversations as anyway separate from the rest of whatever is going on. So I just want to thank you for joining us and taking the time out of your life to spend time with creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Hope that we get a chance to hang out sometime and just have ordinary time to connect.
I'd love that. All right. Yeah. Thank you so much. Really been a treat.
Thanks, Jay. Okay. Thank you.
There you have it, folks. Episode number 48 of the Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck podcast on the Be Here Now Network with our guest, Jay Michelson. We would like to thank Jay for taking his time and joining us and sharing his wisdom and experience in conversation with David. We would like to thank all of you for listening and again encourage you all to pick up a copy of his forthcoming book. Again, we'd like to thank Be Here Now Network for hosting and distributing this podcast. We encourage everyone to head over to BeHereNowNetwork.com and listen to all the amazing podcasts there. And also, if you like this podcast, we encourage you to, you know, give us a positive review, share on social media, subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to. It helps us out. And please head over to DharmaMoon.com. So that's it for the end today. Thank you for listening. We sincerely hope this podcast is of benefit to you and your life. And in closing, may you be safe healthy, happy, and at ease. All the best.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What would you like to get off your chest? Are you holding on to secrets, fears, or frustrations? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. Don't keep it all bottled up inside. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, change negative thought patterns, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/beherenow today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/beherenow.